We know of new methods of attack. The Trojan horse.
Greetings and welcome back to another exciting installment of the Fifth Column Podcast. This is your weekly rhetorical assault in the news cycle, the people that make it, and occasionally ourselves. It's hard for me to say it because today I don't really want to attack myself. I want to love myself. I'm good enough. I'm swift enough. I'm handsome enough. Yeah. And God damn it, you people don't deserve me. I'm Camille Foster. I'm delighted to be here with Matt Welch, Michael Moynihan, and we're podcasting.
Do you want to just log off, Camille, and Matt and I can take it from here?
No. No, not at all.
Are you as
you'd be lost.
Are you as swift as those UCLA UCLA plastic badge, trash can badge wielding students? Did you see that clip? It's the best one.
No, what is that one? I stopped paying
attention. They kind of, no. I don't know if they originally thought they were going to like rush the cops, or they ran in the direction of cops, and the first cop just fucking dick butt kissed him, just clotheslined him, and the rest of them like, and everyone's been re-editing it with yakety sacks.
And oh yeah, I know. I saw that was the Benny Hill one.
But even better, someone did the NFL films type of things, like the splendor on display. So there wasn't a lot of Swift.
There is the problem. Therein lies the problem with these protests, is that the kids want to play revolutionary, but they all have like pipe cleaner arms and like have never lifted anything more than like a bong. And they're like physically like look unhealthy. They're like putting on hard hats and like, we're going to battle the cops. I'm like, those guys from Simi Valley are going to really break every bone in your body and enjoy every minute of it. So I'm not saying that's the right thing to do. I'm just saying they will enjoy it. So you better not. It's best not fight them because they're going to win.
Matt, you just got back from California, as I understand.
I did, yes.
I think you were back a little before things hit the fan at UCLA. But did you see anything?
I didn't
during your time.
I didn't see it, but it was all over the news, right? I mean, UCLA and USC. That's the two basic colleges. There's 1,000 colleges in Southern California, but those are the ones that have the best sports teams. And UCLA was just, this was before the cops finally came in. This is before there was the counter riot, which suddenly incentivized cops to come back in and clear the place. But USC was doing kind of the Columbia University tack of barring reporters. This, by the way, is not a great idea. You're a university. You can be private. You can be public. Doesn't matter. You're kind of an incident.
Wait, the university was doing it, or
the university,
students?
The demonstrators,
both.
Okay, oh, the university was
because the demonstrators were doing it too. Yes. And that didn't surprise me because they really love Hamas, and Hamas is not really like a free speech zone.
But it's also true. I mean, that's what happened in Portland all the time, right? That not only they would like try to take people, physically take people's cameras if they were filming. Like, you can't film here on the street outside of the police precinct that we're like throwing projectiles into. You can't film. You're not allowed to. And they're trying to do that in their various occupied zones, autonomous zones. Check a journalist. I mean, I on one hand, I don't mind, or I'm not totally put out by them saying I won't talk to journalists. I still think that's a pretty pussy move, honestly. At a protest.
Yeah. I mean, you're used to that.
You're used to that, but when the universities and also the people themselves just say, no, you can't come here as a journalist, that's crazy. And that's being pretty mainstreamed now. It's like it's a kind of an Antifa move. I don't know if that actually started Occupy. I think Occupy Wall Street, they certainly liked it when Camille Foster came through and started arguing about capitalism.
That was fun.
But that seems to be part of the handbook going forward. And, I mean, that's we're living.
Particularly weird for places that have journalism schools.
Yeah.
That you're like, you know, like USC, for instance, that was like a pretty well-known journalism.
I mean, I
what is, like, what is the motivation? What is the motivation for the universities?
I think I can't speak to it. There was an interview with a USC chancellor in the LA Times today that I saw the headline on and didn't read. So I don't know what her thing is. You know, I'm sure it's like protection or safety of the students, but they just don't want the bad news. I mean, Columbia was there.
Don't haul me before Congress. Why do you get hauled before Congress?
That's my act like idiots.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's my suspicion. They imagine that they have some political exposure that could be particularly bad for them. Yeah. So they don't want to talk to the press, but I don't know why talking to the press should be in a particular concern with respect to that. Like this is already national news. Politicians are already talking about this. To the extent you're talking to the press, which generally are going to have some sympathies with you, presumably, like, you ought to be able to push the narrative in a favorable direction. I suppose it's because they have no idea what to do.
There's that. they know there's going to be some like Free Beacon, Fox News people there, freelancers,
sure,
gathering video that's going to make their places look bad, and they don't want to do it.
But they have a practice of ignoring those people. Like, they just don't talk to Fox News, and they do talk to CNN or MSNBC, in which case, again, you're spinning the narrative in a way that's helpful to you.
But again, they just seem totally rudderless.
Yeah,
it doesn't work either, because it's not Fox News that makes them look bad. It's the students that make them look bad.
Yes.
The students themselves are saying things that are, I'll give you an example. This is from today at MIT.
We're recording on Friday.
MIT. Yeah. We're on recording on Friday. MIT, one of the most prestigious universities in the world. And I don't know if this is a student, but it doesn't look like it because the guy looks like he's 7,000 years old. But it's a graduate student labor union support for Palestine encampment protest. And this is what the guy said. And I'm not saying, like, crazy people can show up and say crazy things. This was said to, like, uproarious applause. And he says, all this slander about Hamas and the Muslim Brotherhood the others that are out there fighting the fight, the PFLP's armed wing, which side are you on? We're on the side of the fighters. We're on the side of those that fight the enemy. And there's like an eruption of cheers. It's like, let's go back again to the Tea Party stuff. And some sort of knuckle-dragging racist who has a picture of Obama with a bone through his nose, and it's like literally on the cover of books about the Tea Party, right?
No, I mean,
it's like the representation is like, I don't know, they're cheering for it. It seems like this people have crazy views, and that's what they don't want people to know. But
the one that always got people completely exercised, especially in the summer of 2009, when there was a full-on panic, a media panic about the Tea Parties and their violent racism, was... People would occasionally quote I think Thomas Jefferson line of the Tree of Liberty needs to be, well, you know, cleansed with the blood of patriots. And they're like, see? Yes. Which is why, you know, when Gabby Giffords gets shot, everyone starts looking for the Sarah Palin, you know, having the scope target insignia on her various ads. They just knew that this was going to happen. I mean, Paul Krugman wrote that after that lunatic murder in Arizona. They just knew it was going to happen. So it was the supposition that any kind of illusion at all. I mean, there's a point, I think, sometime around Charlottesville in 2017. So MAGA is ascendant, that now the Gadsden flag is objectively violent and racist. Gadsden flag, which is like everybody at some point has used the Gadsden flag. It's great. Says don't step on snake, you know. it is a classic American text.
It'd be great if it actually said don't step on snake. I don't think it'd be as popular. I think that was like they tried that, they workshopped that, and like I don't know.
That was the first one in Latin, Moynihan.
That was the
pre-Gadsden flag was an early, I think, Revolutionary War thing that said don't step on snake.
It literally said
S-N-E-K.
I've never seen that.
Look it up in Latin.
Is that
what it is?
I mean, I'll tell you what, is like that. Was that like the Italian immigrant brigade that was fighting?
Don't step on the snake.
It's like, you know, like, all right, let's do don't tread on me.
Is this
Luigi.
True? Does it really say that? It said don't step on snake.
S-N-E-K? Yes.
Go find it.
Don't step on snake.
It's fantastic.
Is that real?
Yeah.
What is S-N-E-K? What does that mean?
It's a fucking snake, dude.
Oh, I think it's a joke to mock. People who fly the Gadsden flag. It's a meme, man.
No. It predates it.
What?
It predates it.
Okay.
Well, we have to come to the because it looks as if that you're going to have egg on your face, Matt, if this don't step on snack is.
Yeah, I'm only seeing caricatures of this.
Yeah.
Not like a real.
Yeah.
I mean, I do want to buy one of these now, these cartoon scrawlings of a snake. Right.
This is
no step on SNCC.
No step on SNCC.
No, there's it predates this. I swear. I see the ones you're talking about, but yeah.
Yeah.
What is the best use of our time? Do we proceed or do we sort this out?
We probably have to.
I think we have a legion of listeners that are salivating to mock Matt on this month, so we'll just let this go. We'll let them do it. Okay. We love our listeners so much. We'll let them roast Matt on this one because I wish that were true, and maybe it is, but I'm going to go with maybe it was a meme. And not the old Italian parody, Italian division of you don't step on the snake. But anyway, yes.
It does not predate it. I feel pretty confident about this.
I'm gonna pull a Camille here and actually look at my phone while we were podcasting.
I got my iPad, my phone.
I'm just looking directly at the camera. By the way, I'm here and I'm attentive. But we can talk, Camille, as Matt humiliates himself and discusses what he's wrong about this.
No step on snack.
The thing that I saw this morning, by the way. I want to. Why do you do the snake?
This is the snake.
The American Revolution was just a bunch of immigrants that didn't know what they were talking about.
Oh, I'm confused. I'm confusing it with join or die. That's what I'm confusing it with.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Matt acknowledged that he was wrong. Yeah. But we will name this episode Don't Step on Snake.
No step on snake. I'm buying one of those flags right away.
Totally. That should be our logo now.
It is.
Fly that behind us at like a fucking hostage video with that flag behind
Happy
us.
Happy snake step for all you losers and haters.
That's amazing. But the thing that I saw this morning, one final thing on the protest thing, which is boring, and I love this. This is a new thing that we see. People say, and we talked about this on Megyn Kelly's show, the woman who was like, you have to be paying attention. You're not paying attention to Gaza. You're paying to our protest. And it's like you're literally standing in front of a bank of microphones to the media. It's like, what are you doing? Like, you don't understand how this works. But this is the incredible thing. They just are trying, like, we're trying to get attention for this, and you pay attention and they get mad at you. And like, they also think that you can't walk and chew gum and pay attention to two things at once. And the reason that you have to pay attention to this stuff is because I saw this morning that the rough estimate from NBC News this morning is that 2,000 people have been arrested on college campuses in the past couple weeks. 2,000.
Kind of a lot.
There's a lot of people.
A lot of people.
Things have been trashed and like graduations have been canceled and places have been, you know, like at Columbia, like smashed and wrecked and spray painted and January 6th. Did you see Al Sharpton, by the way?
No.
Oh, I got to get this quote. Al Sharpton.
What did he say about Hymietown this time?
No, actually.
No, he said something that was right and people got mad at him on MSNBC.
That the protesters are doing it for themselves and not for the cause.
Well, he said...
He's got some knowledge about that as well.
Yeah, he does. He's like, you got to burn down a Jewish store. Freddie's Fashion Mart. How do the Democrats... This is Al Sharpton talking.
How do Democrats...
That's not bad.
Why was traffic problems emails sent? That is a direct quote, by the way.
Reading from a teleprompter.
I know that one very well about Chris Christie. Why was traffic problems emails sent? How do all of us on that side say January 6th was wrong if you can have the same pictures going on college campuses?
What?
Mika Brzezinski responds, good Lord, don't make a parallel with January 6th.
Oh, Mika.
You stepped out of your lane, sir.
Yeah, I was like, what are you doing? You're a wind-up toy. You're not supposed to say that.
Yeah, don't white woman Al Sharpton. Yeah. Let the black man speak his truth.
And he said, you lose the moral high ground.
Yes.
Right afterwards, yeah. So I love good Lord to the reverend. But Al was right. Got to give Al some credit.
Wow.
Broken clock. Jeez. Broken anti-Semite.
I wonder if he'll reverse himself. Because that's almost too good.
Huh. I think Al has reversed his anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
Yeah?
I do. I actually do. I think that, like, in the moment at the time when he was the rabble-rousing street psycho and the tensions between blacks and Jews in Crown Heights and stuff. And
heroic civil rights crusader is what you mean to say, but I understand.
No, I think he's a monster in almost every way. But I think that I have to allow for my political enemies, and I believe him to be a political enemy, the room to grow up. You know, it's late to grow up, but the guy was a nut back in the day. You know, he's on Morton Downey Jr. fighting with Niger Innes, like literally physically fighting. Mm-hmm. And the guy's like, he's a different guy now. Does he have the same views? Unfortunately, mm-hmm. he does. But I think that he's probably tempered from the real, like, kind of, it was kind of black nationalism at the time, like the street protests. Yeah. You see them walking in this phalanx, and it's just like, it's like an outtake from Do the Right Thing, you know?
I suppose it's in that kind of genre.
One
of the drawbacks of losing all that weight, I mean, Al Sharpton used to be a formidable fighter. And you could imagine that if you got into a brawl with him, that he might really hurt you. You know, he'd get you in the corner, put his weight on you, put a big forearm on your throat. he'd get you. Skinny Al, with all them skin flaps.
Yeah. I mean, I could literally walk two steps in the other direction and he would just be winded at that point. It'd be like he'd hit you with his medallions. That would be the problem.
The medallions and the tracksuits.
Yeah, the tracksuits.
He should bring that back on MSNBC just for one night. Just one night a week. Yeah. He does Skip Bayless, wear the medallions.
He does do like don't say shit. Workout videos where he used medallion. To. It's been a while since I've
seen
it. Of like pictures of him doing workouts in the morning because he's getting after it. And he's in the sweats. He's ready to go.
I want to see Chris Cuomo and Al Sharpton doing a workout video. Chris Cuomo and Al's workouts.
One of the things I miss about going on MSNBC, which I used to do a lot, is Al. Like, I really enjoyed doing his show. I enjoyed hanging out with him. And I really enjoyed the commercial break conversations. Because he's got a long relationship with Trump. A long, long one. They go to the same cigar club together. They have all this kind of back stuff. He told a story, and I'm sure I must have mentioned this early on in this podcast history, of him having a conversation with Trump right after Trump won in 2016. And there is like basically just this outer borough like bonding between the two of them, and like it was like a tender, interesting moment like between Trump and Al Sharpton in 2016. He's a pretty good guy. Loves him some Prince. We talked a lot about Prince back in the day too. And
this is, by the way, going to be our most controversial episode. There's an interlude in the episode in which we're praising Al Sharpton.
I got no problem with it.
But you know, the only time I saw him at MSNBC, I did Chris Hayes' show one time. I think I might have told the story once. And I came out of the studio, and there was like a radio studio in there, like a podcast kind of studio. And it's like no cameras, just microphones in there. And it's like a long, I remember it'd be kind of red. And I walked by and Al Sharpton was in it sleeping. It was awesome. He was just like asleep. And I was like, is that Al Sharpton? But yes, Al Sharpton still has crappy, terrible views. And he has never apologized for Tawana Brawley, which makes him, you know, he can't be redeemed just for that. And he's never acknowledged that Tawana Brawley was lying. He's never apologized to Stephen Pagones, who he falsely accused of raping Tawana Brawley, who was not raped. All of that shit that he did in the past is inexcusable. I think, though, that he probably internally has moved on some issues. That's all I'm saying. The other thing is, to Matt's point about, like, he is friends with Trump, I remember a mutual friend of ours who I won't name, even though he's passed away, and you'll know who I mean, that used to go in D.C., and he was kind of a lobbyist, and have to go with him to Morton's Steakhouse, which is where all the lobbyists kind of congregate. And it was really fun, like as an anthropologist, to go in there and look. And I remember going in one time and seeing him at a table with someone who turned out, because he was from Illinois, turned out to be one of his very close friends, Jesse Jackson Jr.
Oh, yeah. Mm.
And this guy's very libertarian, kind of even more, I think he became even more right-wing. And they were like really tight. And it's like, that's kind of the weird secret of DC sometimes. And maybe that's changed now. But it used to be that like all those people, you know, they're all friends and everyone knows each other. And it's not as you know, smash mouth politics as people think.
No, and game respect game too, also.
Like. Yeah. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Jesse Jackson Jr., we haven't heard from him in a while.
Game recognized game. Yeah.
Where is he now? We should get him on the show. He got out of prison a long time ago.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he went to prison. He got up in like 2015 or 16 or something.
Speaking of Jackson, I would just recently on the airplane watched a documentary about Roberta Flack because there's literally nothing else to watch. And shockingly interesting. And it seems pretty clear that she had an affair with Jesse Jackson in the early 70s. Just the way that they kind of talk about it, and she's spending time and with him, and they traveled together to Ghana, and you know, was breaking up with her first husband right around that time, and they have Jesse on, and this is a recent documentary, and Moynihan knows that it's hard to get something comprehensible out of his mouth these days. You just the words get kind of.
Was it a recent one?
Yeah, yeah.
Huh. Well, he was,
they didn't show him. It was just a voiceover. So
I did not sleep with her.
they don't deal with
my grape turned to a raisin.
They don't deal with it directly. but Camille, you should watch it because she's comes out of Washington D.C. and Virginia. Yeah, yeah. She was actually in an interracial couple before Loving versus Virginia, and they lived in Virginia, interracial marriage, and just like infinitely more interesting than I would have ever guessed. They lived next.
No, I'm a huge fan of Roberta's. I mean, you know, I'm an enormous fan of Donny.
See,
Hathaway.
I didn't realize that.
Convinced. Mm-hmm, I was going to say I'm convinced that Donny Hathaway is perhaps the greatest crooner in history. Like, he is unbelievable, and he famously died at like 33.
At 30?
He jumped out of a window of the Essex Hotel. In New York, Essex House Hotel. Yeah. And he had actually just been in, he was in, but the reason I'm mentioning this is because Donnie was in New York recording with Roberta, and Jesse Jackson actually spoke at the funeral. So he was friendly with all of those people. That's wild.
It is wild.
I'm definitely going
to
watch
the man jumped to his death.
Yeah.
We should do, by the way, we should do a podcast series of the mysterious deaths of crooners and start with Sam Cooke. And then,
what a great idea!
Donny Hathaway. There's a lot of
we
weird
do
stuff.
That.
And you know what's his name? Baby Huey, who I've actually, you know, did an exit song on a paid WeTheFifth.substack.com people podcast with Baby Huey's song. But he was like an incredible, like up and coming. His first record is unbelievable. It's produced by Curtis Mayfield. And it sounds like a Curtis Mayfield record. And he died in like a motel room, I think of a heroin overdose. And he was like really big. And he was going to be, there was like, you know, people thought that he was going to be a big star. And there's a couple of real banger tracks on that first album. It's really good. And he died super young too.
And Sam Cooke was shot in a motel?
Yep.
Is that right?
That's right.
Like he was just like in there with a woman and somebody bursts in and murderates him.
Yeah.
It's absolutely terrible.
Yeah, Baby Huey died in 1970. Mm-hmm. And you can see why he's Baby Huey, because it's like a bald guy being called Curly, because he's a enormous fat man. He had a heart attack in a motel room.
Oh, man. Yeah, Donnie's situation, really, really sad. I mean, he'd kind of fallen off and was getting back to stardom again, and was he had just severe mental health issues, it seems. Apparently he had run out of the studio that night screaming about like white people trying to kill him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they tried to calm him down, and everybody goes back to their hotels, and he apparently just kind of opens a window on a cold, rainy night and leans out of it and falls to his death. Just really tragic.
Well, let's tie this together, and then we can get back to other subjects.
Yeah.
That Baby Huey, I just had to look this up because I want to see when he died.
Did he step on Snack? Did Baby Huey?
He stepped on Snack. He was secured in 1969. He died in 1970. That record came out in 1970. He secured a audition with Donny Hathaway, and Hathaway came by the Thumbs Up Club to see them play. And then Curtis Mayfield comes, and then they sign them. But one of the weirdest elements of the best, absolutely the best band name ever, is called Baby Huey and the Babysitters, which is a fucking great band name. But this is a great little factoid for people, and this people is why you listen to this podcast. The Babysitters were a popular live act, but never took the time out to record an album. They toured widely in the U.S. and were seen by a member of the Rothschild family who flew the band to Paris, France to play at a family ball.
What?
I want to see the Babysitters bootleg at the Rothschild ball. Like, man, who are these motherfuckers?
Trilateral commission all gathering up.
Yeah, yeah. Alex Jones, like, I can't believe it. Baby Huey, he's behind 9/11. Like, good Lord.
I know we're supposed to move on to other things, but I just, as you were talking, Moynette, I just saw this photo of Sam Cooke being wheeled out of the hotel on, it looks like, I mean, is that, that's not a gurney. It looks like one of those loaders for furniture.
It is.
He's covered in some sort of sack.
That's a weird photo. Yeah.
The description of the photo, Cook's body is removed from the office of the motel.
The office.
He was reportedly wearing just a top coat and one shoe.
Yeah.
Good Lord.
That's a dolly.
Yes.
Oh my God, that is awful.
Yeah, that's a dolly.
Oof. What a voice, though.
Rest in peace.
I'm trying hard not to break into the song right now. I'm trying hard. Oof. Change gonna come. All right. What else should we talk about today? We talked a little bit about the protests, the insanity of the universities, the various... there are various politicians who are saying things about this, and we haven't really fully weighed in on this yet. I guess just yesterday, Joe Biden made some remarks for... really the first time. I mean, people had been asking his press secretary for some comment about this earlier in the week, and it was bizarre because they are usually, you expect a vociferous defense of people who are on the left agitating for justice in various ways. And when people would ask her direct questions, should the university be calling the police on these kids? Should the protests come to an end, et cetera, et cetera? Universities can make whatever policies they want. You know, we were going to stay out of this. We're not going to get involved. We don't have anything to say about this. But finally, on Thursday, Joe Biden breaks his silence for all intents and purposes on the matter, and says pretty directly that you, of course, have a right to protest, but that breaking shit is not free speech and is unacceptable and is, in fact, a kind of violence. So don't do that, which it might have been nice to hear that a little earlier. But I wonder what you all make of his comments.
It's interesting. Because there's this guy, I think is the deputy press secretary, Andrew Bates or something? Mm-hmm. He came out and said something what Biden was thinking and what he was saying, which was actually a pretty good statement. But it's like, it was really interesting to me that Biden didn't say it himself. He didn't come out and face the cameras because he finds that increasingly difficult. The flashes tend to, you know, give him seizures and he falls asleep. But he said, Joe Biden condemns the use of the word intifada, which I thought was pretty interesting.
Yeah.
And, you know, they frame it, of course, as like hate speech, which is not the way to frame these things. It's not hate speech. It's stupid speech. But they have said this thing about violent protests, because, look, you have an election coming up. If he was a lame duck president, he'd probably get something very different. But you have an election coming up and you're thinking about the left flank of your party. And you're also thinking about the law and order undecideds that don't like this stuff. So somewhere in there, you have to tread that line. And so he's saying, I don't like the intifada stuff. I'm all for protest. When it gets violent, it's bad. That seems like a very basic thing to say. Because that stuff is not about free speech.
Also,
that is about breaking windows and being
crazy. He used the word, and I was glad to see it, disorder. Because I think that's what people have been forgetting about for kind of a long time. Like that somehow public disorder is fine. It's the price we have to pay for removing cops from everything. And I think that is an incorrect view, that public disorder, and I don't mean this in the pure German sense of order, but I mean like someone like sleeping out on the sidewalk in front of my house, smoking a crack pipe or, you know, whatever, is not that's disorder. That is not, you shouldn't be able to, pitch a tent anywhere you want in any city, in my belief. And there's a lot of libertarians who disagree with me. A lot of people at Reason Magazine, where I work, surely disagree with me. But disorder creates votes. I mean, there's a reason why the Republicans took the Congress back momentarily. They don't really manage it in any organized way, but it's because all of the suburban districts around New York City voted Republican while they were voting for Eric Adams as the anti-disorder candidate. That's why George Santos got into office. No one knew who he was. Moynihan's friends gave him all the money. and they showed up, and he was crazy, and it was fine. But he was running against disorder, and he was a Republican, actually. It didn't matter. Like, the existing Democrats were the problem. That is a swing vote, but so is also those same people tend to be not happy when Republicans say we're going to ban abortion at 6 weeks and trying to go after IVF too. So those people are absolutely in play. He's right to go after disorder. And I think there's a lot of people on the left and among libertarians who have been absolutely downplaying disorder, like and mentioning, you know, it's the people who from 2,000 miles away try to tell you that the city that you live in is not as how you're experiencing it. Those are my like seriously favorite, like literally my 15-year-old was almost late for school today because the F train, someone died on it. She had to evacuate.
Again? Isn't it like the second time this has happened to her?
No, one time it happened to me recently. Yeah. There was a mass shooting on the C train.
Yeah.
It's a charnel house down there. It gets really
so
ugly.
Disorder is bad.
How much of it? That's good to know. So you guys are saying I should move back to New York?
100%.
Okay, great.
Yeah, move. Great. Build a wall and move behind the wall, like upstate and
if you,
Westchester.
If you were in New York right now, Camille, you could be attending, you could be around these very, very fierce and brave dissidents like Michael Moynihan.
I'm my palm with silver and I'll do whatever the fuck you want. Okay?
There's a not insignificant, I know this last night, there's one of the things that happens, Camille, in New York City, is that there's more events that are interesting with people doing things that are relevant to the industry that you work in than other places like wherever the fuck you live.
No, it's absolutely true.
So I was...
one final thing on the student thing. I wonder, you know, this is, I think, probably not related. Mm. But we have another $6 billion in student loans being forgiven.
Mm. Yeah. It's a great timing for that, by the way.
I think they've said it's $29 billion that they've done already. That's the claim.
This is for the Art Institute.
So I pulled up the White House statement on this, which is because it was specifically for the art institutes, you know, these chain of schools. And I have to find this because the reasoning was pretty funny. This is from a news story about it because I can't find it in the actual statement. In the case of the art institutes, the education department's investigation found that the company falsely claimed that 80% of its graduates found jobs in their field of study within 6 months of graduation. In reality, the figure never rose above 57%. I mean, like, we're giving billions of dollars in debt relief to 310,000 people because they said 80% when it was closer to 60%. And you trusted them and you said, well, that's why I'm doing this. I mean, clearly they would never lie about anything. The lack of skepticism you have means you don't deserve a job. And the fact that you went to the Art Institute is probably harder to get a job than if you went to like a computer science program.
Wouldn't the mechanism here that if it any of this were to make sense be that, oh, okay, Art Institute, you violated some threshold of activity here, so you don't get federally guaranteed student loans for your students.
Correct.
Wouldn't that yeah. that's what you would do in this situation?
You find them.
You find them or whatever.
The government should pay them. The government should not be paying people. I mean, the Art Institute should be fined if they violated laws. Okay, that's not a problem.
My obsession these days is with, especially since we have two major parties that are who love tariffs, love Made in America shit, and all this. And sorry for offending those who like that stuff, but that's how I see it. It makes everything more expensive. My obsession is that there is politics out there available, argumentation available for people who say, you know what? I'm going to lower your costs. I'm going to look at things that cost a lot of money and try to have the government stop doing the things that makes it more expensive. What Biden is doing is he's selecting privileged class of people that he's hoping will vote for him. Mm-hmm. And then makes everything else more expensive for everybody else, and hoping that the dispersed costs will be such that those of us who are not going to get that debt relief and who do not identify as Art Institute people will not be mad about. I think that's terrible. Like, it's bad politics, but it's just like it's immoral on some level. Like, you know, don't go into debt. It's not my fault.
Matt, do you know what the polling is like on the debt forgiveness? Just given the bizarre dynamics, I'm curious. I mean, we should definitely check that out.
I would assume that it's bad, but it's also not a high, high. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You don't care about it that much.
you know. Yeah.
If you're reminded of it, you think, my God, that sounds. It's like civil asset forfeiture. If people hear about it and know what it's like, they're like, holy shit, really? That can you can
and
steal stuff.
I guarantee but it's not you, those numbers are really skewed and much higher. The disapproval amongst like working class,
absolutely,
people who didn't go to college and like, why the fuck do I have to pay for your college when I didn't get to go to college because at the time I couldn't afford it.
And the best,
you know, because that's the real issue.
And the vast majority of the shit goes to graduate degrees. So graduate degree, Ivy League schools, debt forgiveness. What? No.
So I'm looking at a CNBC poll. And again, I'm browsing it quickly because I didn't know. But it suggests that around 7 in 10 voters, 73%, believe the government should take some action on student loan debt, with 50% supporting partial or complete loan cancellation, the survey found. And I suppose part of this is people presuming that when they say cancellation, it costs no one anything. You know,
correct.
You owe the money to the government.
Yes.
And that's why it's okay. So the way that the polling question is phrased is very, very important. And to the extent people actually know that, no, Matt Welch, who did not finish a university degree, I'm going to say that again, did not finish at school. I mean, he's bad. Mm. He's like dropped out.
He's the weakest link in this punk.
And who has two young daughters who perhaps will go to university when he may have to pay for that. He is being asked to pay off other people's student loans. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's okay, voter? I suspect that a smaller percentage of voters would say, oh, yeah, that's great. No, you should probably forgive their debt. Yeah. I don't even know what that phrase is incredibly misleading.
Well, they think of it as like if you steal a candy bar from Walmart. Yeah, they're not going to feel it. It's like it's a dollar candy bar. It's like they lost it. It's like it's Walmart, right? They have so much money. There's a sense that people think that about the government, particularly when it comes to things like healthcare. Mm-hmm, and, you know, I was reading and talking to somebody about this, but the NHS and the problems of the NHS in England and like how like basic care is really good. It's very difficult to get anything specialized, et cetera. And when we talk about the NHS, it's like, why can't we have that? It's like, well, I suppose we could. And it's not as easy as you think it is. We can't just print money and everybody takes care of everything. And it's easy. Like, Matt, you sent something along. I can't remember who it was from. It was a tweet about the kind of long tail of the cost of student debt forgiveness.
Yeah, I don't.
And I'm trying to remember who it was.
I don't have it on
my. Whatever it was, really jarring. I'll try to find it and put it in the show notes.
Nellie Bowles had a thing in her TGIF newsletter today that like reprinted that graphic. It is staggering. It's like at some point the debt forgiveness stuff, at least according to a quick glance at this bar chart, ends up being much more than the government actually pays on education.
On state funded education from K through 12, right?
Yeah. And
wasn't that the comparison?
I think so. I mean, state funded education K through 12 traditionally has been $40 billion a year. And then during COVID, and this is one of the great scandals that's not really been covered that much, during COVID, they're like, okay, cool, we're just going to add $220 billion to that real quick to help with the ventilation. Which they helped with so much that Baltimore is closing its schools this week because it's too hot.
But at least they don't have COVID.
They don't have COVID. The money went to hiring and feather bedding union contracts. It just 95% of the money.
But if we think about that for a second, if it is $40 billion, if that was the average pre special circumstances of COVID. And just for students at the art institutes, which advertised on television, by the way, if you remember, they were like television and subway ads.
Fry shit,
it's $6 billion. And it's $40 billion for the entire education budget of the United States. And we're giving $6 billion to people who went to the art institute because 60% of them got jobs and not 80%.
Now, in fairness,
I'm sure it's more than that.
The federal government.
I mean, I'm sure there's more complaints than that.
The federal government's not in charge of K through 12 education. So, I mean, for a long time, Republicans used to say we should, get rid of the Department of Education. A couple of them still do, but their heart is not in it. So it's just sort of extra money to try to influence outcomes in certain ways, or, you know, hire teachers, it ends up just being as bad as you can imagine.
No, I just mean that as a basis for comparison. I know it's not the overall budget for, I mean, states are taking care of that stuff, but just as the federal contribution to that, you think, like, as a frame of reference, you're like, well, that is a, that is staggering, that $6 billion. And I, the story that I saw was that, and I don't know how this is possible, and it's a very, very good job of the Biden administration if they've managed to do this and we didn't notice that that the debt forgiveness is up to $29 billion now. I saw that somewhere. Over the last 3 years, my administration has approved nearly $29 billion in debt relief for 1.6 million borrowers whose colleges took advantage of them, closed abruptly, or recovered by related court settlements, compared to just 53,000 borrowers who have ever gotten their debt canceled through these types of actions before I took office. Anyway, that's a lot of money, $30 billion.
Another bit of that is a lot of money, and it's relevant to the performance of schools and such during COVID, is that K through 12 is funded state and local level. That's 25% more or less of state and local governments. That's a huge, huge chunk. It's property taxes or it's some other type of tax. So, and those, that's just increasing. Plus they got this huge pile from the government, which is about federal government, which is about to run out. And they did this all at a time that enrollment is dropping like a rock, right? So you're spending way more tax dollars. And that tax dollars has to come from taxes. You can borrow some of it, but now, you know, borrowing costs, I think, have already eclipsed or about to eclipse military spending, which is an insanely high number on the federal level. So people will at some point look around and say, huh, I'm paying a lot of taxes here in my city, state, which Moynihan and I certainly are. That goes to pay for this thing that is free and is so bad that nobody wants it anymore. Again, with the low cost stuff, like if you make my life more low cost, I will be more likely to stay wherever it is that I live and be happier about it.
Welcher, did you just call me a tax cheat?
Yes.
Well, no, you live in California.
I mean, I would if I could, but I pay a lot of money in taxes.
Dude, he pays more than us. He lives in California.
That's true.
Yeah.
It's more punishing taxes than we do.
Okay, but I just want to go on the record.
I mean, I don't know where you live. It's been so long since I've seen you. You, like, float above Jamaica in a thought bubble.
Amazing. Camille's calling in from Manitoba, and we don't know that. The thing that seems, and we have a lot of very smart listeners who are economics people, economists, work at think tanks, et cetera. So this is the part where you're just going to shake your head and say, of course, I mean, we all know that. But I don't know if we do. And here's the basic thing to remember about college that people don't point out. And the comparison to me is always when, you know, people that I know, or, you know, my daughter or somebody will say, such and such a basketball player or, you know, baseball player is overpaid. And then I have to calmly say, no, companies do not overpay people en masse that way. They earn that money. And when you sell a jersey, a LeBron jersey in China, that's part of that money that LeBron is getting for his salary. He's not being overpaid. He's probably being slightly underpaid, you know, in some of these cases. And that is the same thing with college. So when we talk about this, we took out all this debt. It's like people are rational economic actors. They just are, you know, by and large. I mean, people, there's a lot of people who aren't and just, you know, bet on the lottery all the time. But people are by and large rational economic actors because they understand that they pay this money and they will ultimately make more because of it. Do I think that college is a good deal for people? I do not. And I do actually, I'm getting Peter Thiel about this and recommending that people do what Matt does and go for a year and say, you guys are all fucking nuts, and then quit and make your own way in life. Because you don't need, you know, sort of Palestinian puppet theater classes to, you know, do something in life that is worthwhile. But I would say that, like, if you look at the numbers, just the raw numbers in this, when you say, oh, they're paying so much, it's like they are earning that money back with better jobs and better salaries. And if they think that wasn't the case, they wouldn't do
it. And
that is basic.
We're at a time now where overall college attendance in the U.S. is on the decline. It hit a peak and is starting to go down. Some of that is foreign, and a lot of the U.S. college system operates, stays afloat because so many foreigners want to come here. And we let in fewer foreigners, so that has helped hurt it. But also, people born and raised here are not going to college at any higher rates. I think what you will see is that that traditional measure that Moynihan refers to, which Nick Gillespie loves to talk about because he's a big higher education fan, and he's a doctor, as we all know, is that that ratio,
hi everybody,
that ratio will go down because the prices have been going up so much over the last while. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then also, right. I think at some point there's going to be a reputational hit associated with this stuff. People are not going to automatically, one hopes, do the like, oh, you went to Harvard and Yale, that's great. At some point, there's going to be like, please tell me you went to a school with a football team. And the chances are you're going to have less puppet theater on the quad and more pep rallies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to give me the motivated state school person at the law firm over the, you know, cosseted Ivy League prep school grad. And I think that will change. That will make those places incredibly cost effective compared to the higher cost elite schools, so-called.
You know, I have to admit something.
Oh.
My daughter's looking at high schools now, right?
At high schools?
It's horrible. She can't go to public high school here because I can't afford the amount of Kevlar, the designer Kevlar that you would need. The stab
Why don't you just
vest.
say what you really mean? There's too many Negroes in that school, and you don't want to send your daughter.
My daughter goes to a private school, and she's the only white girl in class. That is actually true. So that is not the case, Camille.
I knew that.
If I wanted her to go to school with white girls, I would move and go to a public school in Park Slope, which is a lot of honkies. But yeah. It's funny that you look at...
Levy is going to be starring in Save the Last Dance pretty soon. It's going to be amazing. you got the moves, girl.
What was that Kirsten Dunst? What was that girl's name?
Oh, my gosh. I forget. I think she's like a realtor or something now. No, yeah. No. I mean, no shade there. Like,
yeah, yeah.
She has a normal job.
Yeah, so the thing that I've been doing, and I catch myself doing this,
yeah,
and I think I need implicit bias training.
Julia Stiles.
But mm-hmm. I'm like looking at the students. And mm-hmm. like, if you go to like a school, like, and look this up, people, if you don't, there's no reason for you to know like New York private high schools. Well, you should know them because you can tell because every fucking idiot on cable news went to one of them. So that's important to know. Like, mm-hmm. there's a school called Elizabeth Irwin, which is a communist, started by communists. And it's literally called the Little Red Schoolhouse. They call it the Little Red Schoolhouse. I'm not joking. Not a joke. It's like notoriously. But it's funny. It has a habit of like creating neoconservatives. Like Elliot Abrams went there and Ron Radosh went there. Like all these red diaper babies that went there and rebelled. But if you go there... And then you go to St. Anne's, where all the mm-hmm. girls who made the show Girls went.
Nancy Rahman, too.
Nina Dunham and such. Nancy Rahman went there, too. There's always the exception to the rule.
She was kicked out for bad grades, but yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's
there it is. Yeah. That's good.
Yeah,
otherwise, she'd be pretending to do butt stuff on TV.
Yeah. Instead, she went to PS 1068 in East New York.
Got just fine.
Yeah, just graduated last year. But besides GED Rommelman, you go to those schools and you look at the students, and I'm just like, I see the darkness in these kids and like the depressed kind of looks, and they're like, oh my Lord. And you know, they just look like future Gaza protesters, all of them. And then you go to like a couple of other tours of schools, two sort in particular, but I won't mention their names. I don't want to jinx my daughter's chances. And it's a really different vibe, right? Like one was mostly foreign students, because it's, you know, where it is, and it's the children of foreign people for, you know, a variety of obvious reasons if you knew the school. And another one that was downtown that had like this athletics program, and my daughter is a very competitive gymnast, a very good gymnast, and spends most of her time doing that. And it's just like, oh no, if you're like an incredible, like, you don't want to go to these schools where everyone, their parents are like the type of people that have things in their window that say, in this house we believe. Yeah. don't want to go to school where all the parents are doing that. So, mm-hmm. so I'm just saying that's in high school in New York too. Mm-hmm. You know, there's always a little mini Columbia. I'm surprised that Dalton has not had a takeover of the lunchroom or something in support of the West Bank to be a little different.
It's a matter of time.
Speaking of In This House We Believe. I'm in Oakland today recording, and I stopped at this coffee shop, the only place for miles, it seems, that is actually open before 8 o'clock, to just grab some things. And I'd been to the shop before, and I probably mentioned it on the podcast, or at least to you guys, that they had this sign in the window they'd recently been broken into, et cetera, as most of the stores around here did at the time. And I asked, you know, just how's it going around here? How things been? And they're like, oh, everything's fine. Yeah. It's like, oh, that's cool. And she's like, where are you from? And we talk a little bit about New York. And I mentioned that I'd left and during 2020 when things were crazy. And she's like, things were crazy in New York in 2020? I was like, yeah, you don't remember? Like the protests and the general unrest, et cetera. I mean, happened here too. And she said, yeah, but I think we fared a little better because people here just tend to agree with one another. And I said, well, okay. But the burglarization and all of the craziness, like here, the general unrest. Yeah.
Oakland is the saddest.
So
case,
crazy.
Of any American city. I mean, they're even losing their fucking baseball team, which is a terrible baseball team.
They're actually playing pretty well this year, though.
They're playing pretty well this year, but like they've been a basement dwelling team for a while, and the Alameda County Stadium's not the best place to see a baseball game. The mausoleum. But I had a friend here who lives by you, and Camille, you know him.
Yeah,
and
he's great.
Another mutual friend that you also know, a guy named Alex.
He's also great.
I think he either works in Oakland. Oh, he was working at a company in Oakland, and they basically had to shut down because they were getting robbed. And he was telling me the story that
we talked about it. Yeah,
that they like people were like they would drive in and just steal all the computers, put them in the car, like during the day. Like just walking into the place where they were renting, it was like a studio where they do like filming and stuff like that. I don't know if they're doing commercial work or what, but he gave me a broad idea of it and steal everything. And just like everything is like, yeah, we all get along. It's like, okay, so why does it look like Baghdad in 2004? Like it seems Oakland is like the carjackings there are wild. It's nuts. I mean, I was in Oakland not too long ago, and I thought it was just one giant tent city, it looked like. I guess it was maybe where I was driving. But I do like this. It has some really cool aspects to the city.
It's a lot, really to sad. Like. Yeah. There's a lot to like. I mean, it's a beautiful, beautiful day, and the weather is nearly always perfect most of the year. It's not fire season. And it's just kind of bizarre how underpopulated it seems and how little trafficked the kind of commercial sections are. And then you go to the grocery store to grab a sandwich or something, and there's always a homeless guy with a backpack like just stealing shit. Just stealing shit. So
well, if you are in Oakland, go to one of a great bar called Heinold's. Do you know this place?
No.
Heinold's First and Last Chance. Heinold's. It was the old Jack London. He used to hang out there. It's right on the water. And it's probably like a bit of a tourist trap now or something. But it's a death trap, maybe, is what I'm trying to say. Just getting there.
They have one of those zombie vehicles, and they just kind of pack everybody in, drive through as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
So it's
fine. But that part is a cool place.
I don't get shot. But yeah, other stuff that we should get to this week. Matt, I know you were looking at that NPR piece.
Yeah.
There's the story in the New York Times that described the situation at NPR as a crisis, quote unquote.
I wouldn't have found out about this except I was driving around LA and listening to KPCC, which is one of the two NPR stations there. And they had Larry Mantle, who's been doing public broadcasting there for 40 years. He's really good. And he brought in the author of that, Ben Mullins, I think it is. Piece to talk about it, and it was a very interestingly frank discussion. Larry Mantle's always been able to he's very ideologically open and can talk to people of all sorts. Yeah, like Patrick Ruffini on right after Ben Mullins, and they were throwing stats from this thing that blew my mind, right? So this is all in the wake of the Uri Berliner piece in the Free Press and the backlash to it. But they had been working on the story for 6 or 7 months before that NPR is at this crisis moment because they're losing a ton of listeners. Their ad model is collapsing, and it's kind of unclear what the podcast model is going to do for their entire business. So that's what they were working on, and the kind of internal problems. But also, this the thing that Uri Berliner identified as, like, you guys are just doing identity politics to death, and it's embarrassing, which is what so many people have been saying about NPR for the last 5 years. Turns out to be, like, fundamental strategy that they called the North Star.
They capitalized the North Star.
It's the North Star strategy to diversify NPR. And so the same thing that you know, everyone has been making jokes about, they've been trying to do it. And as they've done that, in the last 4 years, their number of listeners has gone from 60 million to 42 million. That is a fucking collapse.
Yeah, it's insane. Amazing.
I mean, we used the phrase before, apply it to Vice and plenty of other places too, you know, go woke and go broke. That's actually happening here. They don't portray it precisely that wasn't necessarily the hook of the story, but it's laced all throughout. You go from $60 to $42 million. The ad market has collapsed. And what happened to the minority listeners to NPR during that period? Nothing.
They're all white.
They link to a Pew Research study, which is interesting, from 2020, so it's not totally current, but they go through, you know, ABC, CBS, NBC, New York Times, and other people as well, and they say, what's your whiteness level? New York Times, NPR is the second whitest behind Fox News. Holy cow, 75%. Wow. Of NPR is white. Actually, New York Times is not that far behind at 71, and Fox is at 87. So they do this big North Star initiative, and all it does, the black listenership, and Camille, you know, just for the sake of argument, that's how they measure it. I'm not endorsing race as a concept.
I know what they do. Yeah. I mean, you kind of are.
It's consistent. It's flat. It's at 11%, which, by the way, you know, sounds like the population.
You don't want too many of those people. That's important. You don't want too many.
And then Hispanic.
Can't have too little.
Hispanic went up 2 percentage points, which probably mirrors the population writ large. And that's it. Hasn't moved the needle while you've driven audience away. And now you're scrambling around for money and having to fire people right and left. Like, it's the best, I think, distillation or example of what we've been sort of positing anecdotally for a long time, which is that nobody wants this. You're putting so much energy into this thing that nobody wants, and it was fascinating listening to the callers come in talking about it, and including someone's like, you know, I'm Hispanic, and I hear you guys use Latinx, and like, what are you talking about? There's something to all of that. Like, it becomes unlistenable and untrustworthy, and people see it as an arm of the Democratic Party, or even, you know, to the left of that, progressiveness, and it just repels people. At what point are you going to stop it? And it seems that they would rather circle the wagons against Uri Berliner and the Free Press, rather than admit
which they did,
what is happening.
Yeah. I want to read two things from this, which I think are really fascinating. Mm-hmm. And you point out the North Star thing. And I want to read the paragraph about this, because there's something really interesting about it. A years-long push to diversify NPR staff, in part to lure listeners beyond its aging and predominantly white audience, hasn't generated the listenership boost some executives had hoped for. But the effort, which NPR's former chief executive called its North Star, had been at the point of contention within the organization long before Mr. Berliner published his essay this month. Now, when you read that, I will say, by the way, I had dinner with Mr. Berliner last night, and he might be the nicest man I've ever met in my life. He's just the calmest, quietest, gentlest, nicest guy, not ideological. Then we get to this statement from Isabel Lara, who's the NPR spokesman. And in her comment, when you read that, you think the North Star is something that the former chief executive just said? Like, yeah, it's kind of our North Star. Like, not it's the name of an initiative. And then the spokesman says, our focus on the North Star, capitalized, has led to increased diversity in our content. Right? Yeah. In our content. The voices on the air, the sources our journalists go to, the broader range of topics and issues discussed in our show. We want to reach people where they are. That last sentence makes no sense. But what you'd notice in that is that it doesn't say anything about listeners. It says about what they're producing. And I get that. I think Ben Mullen here is a very good reporter, and I have no problem. But I mean, he's trying to do this in a way that takes into consideration all the things that could potentially, not a go woke, go broke piece, but I thought this was another fascinating sentence. NPR's traditional broadcast audience, still the bulk of its listenership, is in long-term decline that accelerated when the pandemic interrupted long car commutes for millions of people. Well, hang on. When did our podcast triple in size? During the pandemic. What do people have time to do? Not drive. Yeah, drive. But they're going different places, and they're at home alone, or they're at home bored, and they're listening to fucking podcasts. They're not listening to you. It has nothing to do with the pandemic interrupting long drives. Are you kidding?
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, nonsense.
The other thing that happened during the pandemic is those stations became in fucking sufferable.
Yes.
Like, yeah. You knew what you were going to get. In addition to this sort of deluge of bad news and the constant sort of stock ticker like accounting for the number of people who were dead or presumed to have died from COVID, you were getting your daily dose of completely insane social justice and madness on NPR around the clock. You don't need to listen. As has been pointed out many, many times before, you know what story you're going to get. And any story you get is going to be preceded and concluded with meditations on how blacks and women are the ones who are most severely affected. And only more recently, I suppose, trans people have become the cause du jour.
Actually, I'm wrong.
Gaza is the cause du jour at the moment. Gaza. Not the
trans. One of the callers explicitly mentioned COVID. He's like, I knew what every COVID story was going to sound like. He's like, I even agree with a lot of it, but like, there's no surprise and there's no like credible people with a different point of view.
Yes.
And like, what's the point?
Yeah. If anyone cares to listen, I'm not sure when it's coming out. It's one of these kind of evergreen things that might sit on the shelf for a bit. But I interviewed for Honestly, where I fill in, do about half them these days, did an interview with Steven Pinker yesterday.
Oh.
And in that interview, which was great, I mean, he's this probably the second nicest guy to Uri Berliner, just a really lovely guy. And obviously brilliant. It's always funny to be sitting across from someone that you know is like 50 times smarter than you. But we had a great conversation, a very, very good conversation. But one of the bits, we talked about COVID and, you know, his book Rationality, he talks about people being irrational and making, you know, irrational decisions. And we talked about misinformation. And I asked him this question that, you know, we ask of a lot of people, of like, how much did that damage the credibility? I mean, when you have these things, like all the things that you were told were misinformation and wrong, not only was it that you weren't supposed to talk about it, but some of them turned out to be right. And that's really disorienting for people who are not deeply embedded in this stuff as we are. So yeah, it's a real fun conversation, and we'll post a link to it soon. So, but that was a good one.
What else we got on the docket before we have to punch out of here?
What else do we have on the docket?
I wanted to just give a shout out recommendation. Last night I went to a screening of Meg Smakers. I don't know. Documentary that was originally called Jihad Rehab. Now she calls it Unredacted, but I think the Jihad Rehab is one of the greatest titles. But it's also the reason why the thing got canceled, which is astonishing. It is one of the most egregious examples that we've seen over the last sort of 8 years of people getting shit or themselves canceled for works that no one has read or viewed. And having attributed to them qualities that are just the opposite of what's in the actual film. It is, you will watch it and you'll be furious. So this is, it's the documentary is as it sounds. There's a rehab facility in Saudi Arabia that she managed to get into. She's a real badass, honestly. Former firefighter who at age 21, 9/11 happens, and she decides that she needs to understand Islam and why they hate us, and moves to Afghanistan, and then ends up living in Yemen for 6 years. Just all kinds of crazy shit. Got kidnapped in Colombia for a while, and eventually becomes a filmmaker. Somehow gets herself access into Saudi Arabia at this facility where they take people who are jihadis, the terrorists. In this case, the ones that she follows are sent from Guantanamo Bay. They're Yemenis. And Saudi Arabia agrees to take them and put them through this facility where they do art and talk about their feelings. And they swim and they go in the sauna and they go through this sort of process. And it is like, I would, you know, if you weren't paying attention to where the culture has gone over the last 5 or 10 years, you would have expected the right to be the ones objecting to this. Because as I was at the screening last night, we did a Q&A afterwards, sponsored by Fair. She was updating on one of the characters that she's following. She goes, oh, you know, Nadir now has a wife, and the crowd burst out into applause. This is a bodyguard for Osama bin Laden. And they're like, yay, he found love. Yeah.
Congratulations. We shoot the AKs in the air for you.
But that's...
Those bullets do come
down. That's what happens. And it's not at all an apology. She really has... It's viewpoints very, very neutral. It's just she follows these people in this process, gets their backstories going in, and you just see it, and there's a lot of surprises and twists. Find a way to see it. She has bought the rights to the movie, because what happens was the executive producer, who is like on top five shit list for me like forever, Abigail fucking Disney, right? Who's not only Abigail Disney, but she's a giant in the world of documentary making. Like she's a very important person. She was the executive producer on this, and she said that it was a remarkable film, and it is. It's very good. And then there was pressure. Wait,
I'm sorry. Were you say you don't like her or you do?
No, she's a moral monster and should be defenestrated physically. Mm-hmm. Maybe a second story
window.
She's
also a part of...
Very nice.
No. No, she's not.
She's a fucking awful person.
I had to look up the name of it, the group that she's a part of, and I found it called Patriotic Millionaires. And they are people that petition the government and the World Economic Forum to raise taxes on themselves.
Wait, is she only a millionaire?
She attacked Bob Iger for making too much money, and she has a lot of bad political.
So
views,
she,
but okay. This is
well, I don't have to listen to her if she's.
She
just
was
a
the executive producer.
Her net worth is $120 million.
Called this thing remarkable. Okay. The movie got to Sundance. It's the first feature documentary of this filmmaker whose backstory is incredible, very self-made, and it was an incredible get access to this place. And it's at Sundance, but then some people at Sundance do the Netflix with Joe Rogan thing, and like, you know, we don't feel safe, and it's just a shame that you have this sort of white savior movie, nothing to do with the movie, zero, and that you don't have enough Muslim, and it's just you, playing into anti-Muslim tropes. Dude, we're cheering for jihadis. What the fuck are you talking about? on and on and on. Like, it gives off Indiana Jones vibes. And so they protest, and Sundance pulls it under pressure. And then people pressure Abigail Disney, and she does the hostage note and saying, you know, at first glance, I didn't see that this was actually a truckload of hate. A fucking truckload of hate? What?
She actually said a truckload
it's
of hate.
It's very close to that, yeah. And so she denounced the film. The executive producer of the film, who had called it remarkable and had helped launch this aspiring and very good and very promising filmmaker's career, just torpedoed it. So you can only see it basically wherever Meg Smaker shows up. So she's going to be at Dissident Dialogues with all the brave dissidents like Michael Moynihan this weekend. And
big dissidents. Well, I have something to talk to her about. Because I went on a jihadi rehabilitation program in Libya. And, you know, it's funny that you go on a junket to any whatever country, and people say, like, oh, you're in the pocket of... And I was like, I guarantee you I'm not in the pocket of the Gaddafi regime, because they were the ones that were putting this on. And they were trying to, around 2003, when they voluntarily gave up their nuke program... After the invasion of Iraq.
The last country do that, by the way.
They will ever do that. And they made a huge mistake, obviously, from their perspective. Gaddafi,
clearly,
guy in a Yankees hat, murdered him, which produced one of the funniest New York Post headlines of all time. do you remember
that? Remind me.
They were like cheering the fact that like Yankee fan kills Gaddafi. It was unbelievable. It was like the best. I was like, that is amazing.
That is the worst.
But so yeah, I went on this because Saif al-Islam Gaddafi, which translates to the sword of Islam, Saif mm-hmm. al-Islam Gaddafi, who's still alive, by the way, and escaped and now has made kind of peace with the people who are running Libya now, kind of precariously trying to run Libya now. So we went across the country, and it was one of the most terrifying things I've ever seen in my life. These guys were mostly a part of this group called the LIFG, the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, and they were in Afghanistan, they were in Sudan, they were all over the place. And there was minders with them, like big beefy guys with like gold Gaddafi watches standing over them as they were like, I renounce the jihad. It was like, do you really? And it was the weirdest, weirdest experience. And it was like they're very bad at the kind of what the Soviets got very good at, was bringing people and making credulous academics in America think that everything was amazing. It was like there was no way to think that after going to see all these people who looked like they had been, you know, beaten down over time. And so, yeah, I saw one of those in action, and it was pretty interesting. And it was clearly just a sop to the West and trying to get back in the good graces of the West, right, because they were never in the good graces of the West. But yeah, it's pretty interesting. One more thing before we go, I have something that I think you guys will all be interested in.
Okay.
And this is a story that came up this morning on Axios, that Elon Musk says X will reinstate the suspended account of Nick Fuentes, a white mm-hmm. supremacist and Holocaust denying broadcaster. Mm-hmm. And naturally, all of the usual suspects, who I presume are complaining over
Threads.
Yeah. One of the greatest inventions. You know, I said that where
all the best people
all the best,
are on Threads.
All yeah. the best commentary is.
Yeah, which sharing, is, sharing their thoughts and getting two likes for that.
Seven. I saw one this morning. Was seven. And
that's
it was
amazing.
It's like when all
it's
of your,
gone mini viral.
Could you imagine, like, if Rumble was all content about how YouTube was terrible? Yeah. Because that's what Threads is. It's all like Twitter is awful. And so this is, you know, Axios does these bullet points, and apparently some Fuentes supporter demanded that he be allowed to return to X. And so Musk responded thusly. Very well, he will be reinstated, provided he does not violate the law, and let him be crushed by the comments and community notes. Which I thought was a very good response.
What a ringing endorsement.
It is a great response.
I mean,
and then he tweeted, it's better to have anti whatever out in the open to be rebutted than grow simmering in the darkness. And then Musk posted that he couldn't be a defender of free speech and, quote, permanently ban someone who hasn't violated the law. So obviously everyone's up in arms about this, but he apparently was, he came back and then he was banned again in October 2022, following Musk's purchase. So he has actually banned him before. And the thing about this is, I don't know if it's just me, but here's the thing that happens when you ban people from Twitter. When you ban Donald Trump from Twitter, he creates his own thing, right? He goes somewhere else. And what happens? All of his legion of fans screenshot what he's posted on True Social and post it on Twitter. And it gets 80,000 retweets. Because this is what Donald Trump said. It's effectively his Twitter account, but you're just doing it in the backdoor way. Nick Fuentes, who is astonishingly stupid, and I mean, this man, the only time we've ever mentioned him on the show before is his mm-hmm. brilliant disquisition on the fact that people who have sex with women are the gayest people on the planet. And I was like, no wonder you didn't think the Holocaust happened. You don't understand how anything works. But I see that guy's videos on Twitter, never in my timeline. But if I click through something about Israel, for instance, and you scroll down, thousands of people posting, you know, his groypers posting these videos of him with his soft mustache talking about how women won't fuck him and how the Jews are responsible. So I don't know. I see him all the time.
I mean,
so it's not, they're not doing a good job at this point. So
yeah. Yeah, I mean, it is, he is actually the greatest gift to people who hate racism. I mean, just the notion that he might be the sword and shield mm-hmm. for white supremacy and anti-Semitism. Thank you, Jesus.
Yeah.
He is who we need. He's who we need fighting those battles on the front line, ensuring that America is a safe home for white people and straight people.
It is tempting, though,
stopping
Camille,
the Jews, because he is tempting. Not
very you good see
at it.
A guy like that, and you say, if you follow him, you too can never have sex with women.
And not be gay.
And yeah, not be gay.
Not be gay.
Definitely.
No, it's totally not gay. We're not going to have sex with girls. We'll have sex with each other, and it's not gay.
It's like
they're gay.
That's what the Greeks did and the Romans did, and they were kind of white, right?
Did you see the 300? It's super hot. You should see it again.
Yeah, that's the straightest movie ever. It's like, you know, my favorite movies are 300 and Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. Two of them, the straightest movies ever.
Didn't Gore Vidal actually like work on the costuming of Ben-Hur or one of those things like that in the 50s?
He wrote the script for Caligula. He's one of the writers on Caligula. That one, he might have worked on it. That sounds...
That movie is actually not gay.
That movie is very, very not gay. And it's also like, well, I mean, I don't know. It also it's has inclusive. Some horses in it, too. Mm. So I don't know about that. And not in The Godfather.
That... I'm
in the Caligula.
I'm unfortunately too old. So when that movie came out, I was too young, and I saw like a half a peek, and I was so terrified that I haven't even broached. I would not watch a clip of it to this day. It's just
is that right?
Oh yeah. It like
oh we should do a viewing.
No, we should not.
Someone
nope,
in New York.
Nope.
Yes.
It terrifies me.
Yeah, we're going to have the whole Fifth Column fandom in New York come out for a screening of Caligula with the Fifth Column.
I mean,
you could sit right next to Matt
Moynihan,
Welch.
Now that he's fine,
a couple $1,000, you get to sit next to Matt
The Moynihan East Egg Film Festival needs to happen this year. Yeah.
The Dissidents. No,
let's figure it out.
I'm doing two panels because I was, as I told you guys before, I was tricked into doing one of them. Uh-huh. I wasn't even tricked. I was just put on the panel and wasn't even, and I'm like too nice to say no now. But one of those I will be, it's the one about media. I will be addressing the idea that anybody in that room is a dissident.
Good.
Yeah, and we should be clear that the folks putting this on are friends. Obviously, our own Michael Moynihan will be there, prominently featured twice, apparently, the star of the entire thing. To the extent there's any shade being thrown, it is only at the name, which is a little cartoonish. I mean, dissident, heterodox, come on now.
Go over, by the way, and subscribe to our paid episodes, which are much better. And I'll give you a sample. These ones are terrible. Yeah. I'll give you a sample of what we do over there, because what we do is we read listener letters. We get a lot of them.
Love letters. Yeah.
And I want to just say that we just got one right now. It just popped up while we were signing off here. And it was from somebody named Brenner. And he just wrote, "Fellas, did I miss something on Malcolm Gladwell?" And the whole thing is about how much he sucks and the debate with him and Taibbi. And he said, "My jaw nearly hit the floor at how ridiculous his stance was." I actually listened to that not long ago.
It's like a year ago.
Because I hadn't seen it.
Yeah.
Maybe it's probably like a year ago when I listened to it. And I cannot believe how ridiculous the argument was. That Matt Taibbi wanted to go back to the days when the media was full of white people. That was literally his argument. So if you come on over to wethefifth.substack.com, we answer all of your pressing questions. And we will talk about that, Brenner. And thank you for the email. So,
If I can shout out one thing before we get out of here, I think I mentioned that I was at TED and had an interesting time there last time we recorded. I got to hang out with Sam and Annika Harris for a little bit. And Annika, who wrote a great book about consciousness, had mentioned a book to me that is coming out about plants talking to each other and was praising it. And it has not come out yet, but there is a phenomenal piece in The Atlantic called The Mysteries of Plant Intelligence by one Zoe Schlanger. And I would commend the piece to you. And when the book comes out, you should go out and pick up the book as well. It seems really super duper interesting, and that's just a thing I read this week that I like, that I am encouraging you to read, because plants apparently talk, which is amazing and wonderful.
Okay, Stevie Wonder
we live in an amazing and wonderful place, and the aliens are real, which we now know for a fact. It's been confirmed. This is indisputable. They are apparently angelic entities, evil angelic entities. We should do something about that. Someone should fix that. I'm just asking questions. Look at my funny face. All right.
Anyway. Okay, bye.
We know of new methods of attack.